on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome to the Orient Hour. Thank you very much for Ella for the handover there. And I'm Billy Herring, and next to me is Jamie Stripe. Jamie, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good evening, Billy. Good evening, everybody.
Excellent, fantastic. And it's what do we call today? Do we call today Happy Welcoming Fans Back into Stadiums and Vaccine Day or something? I don't know.
Yeah, Liberation Day.
That's it. Hooray, hooray. All right, okay. So we're going to start off just quickly with a little bit of Jabo Iberé news. Jabo decided to retire today, so we're going to do a little bit of a tribute to Jabo. He made his debut for the O's at 17 against Northampton Town. He played for the Orient for a further 8 years, making over 200 appearances before joining Walsall in 2008. In a lengthy career, Jabo played for a total of 10 clubs, including the MK Dons, Southend, Stockport, Colchester, Oldham, Barnsley, Carlisle and Cambridge. Overall, Jabo made nearly 600 professional appearances in a career spanning over 20 years. Well played, Jabo. We wish you a happy retirement.
Yeah, hear, hear. And what a great career that was, I have to say. Especially a big favourite down at the O's.
Yeah, Jamie, favourite Jabo memory?
Oh, blimey. It's quite a few. I mean, the one that obviously stands out is the near miss in the Blackpool playoff final when he steamed through the Blackpool defence and just hit the ball the outside of his foot at 2-2 and it clipped the post. Obviously, if it went in, you know, the outcome could have been a hell of a lot different. But there was more to his career at Orient than that. I mean, he had the his first two league goals at Macclesfield. That was a great moment for him. I think it was on his debut. And further on down the line in the 2005-06 promotion campaign, you know, made a vital contribution. I think he scored about 9 goals that season. And a really good partnership with Gary Alexander. It kind of laid the foundations for the actual promotion itself. So another couple of great goals on the way. I think there was a brilliant one with the outside of his foot against Lincoln in the FA Cup in, I think it was 2001. And a howitzer at the end to save a point against, I think it was Scunthorpe in 2003-04. So plenty of highlights. You know, never really prolific, but I think that's one of the things we liked about him.
Yeah, I think it's ironic that nowadays we see people like Bobby Firmino, who's not prolific at all. And, you know, back in the day when Jabo was playing for us, he was like a lower league Bobby Firmino, I would say.
Yeah, it was. But again, he was like gloriously erratic, wasn't he? That's, that, and that's the thing about, and that's what endeared him to us.
You could never fault his work rate, though. That was the thing with Jabbo. That's why the fans loved him. It didn't matter if he missed two or three chances. You know, you knew he was going to run right the way, all the way through those 90 minutes.
Yeah, and fans always like appreciate that. I mean, they'll always give someone like that the benefit of the doubt when it comes down to it. Obviously, his finishing wasn't the best, but you know, like I said, it's like part of the charm.
There was a lot more to his game than that, though. So we move on then. Happy retirement, Jabbo, and hopefully we'll be able to get you on the show sometime soon. I know Andy is in negotiations, shall we say, with Mr. Ribéry. So there we go. Okay, so we're going to be moving on through the Port Vale game now, and we're going to do a bit of a review of that because we've got a very special guest on today's show coming up a bit later on, which is the one and only Ricky Otto. So we want to get through the Port Vale review before Mr. Otto comes on in about 10 minutes or so, ladies and gentlemen. So we'll start with Dave Victor's review of the game.
Three straight league win for Ross Embleton's men. I think I lost count with the excitement on Saturday and seeing the O's in the playoff places for the first time this season. I also think I enjoyed Saturday's match more than Leighton Orient's head coach. For me, it was a classic fourth division affair. Two sides looking for victory, full-on tackles, lots of honest mistakes and flashes of real quality. Orient's defending for Port Vale's 11th minute corner was simply not good enough, but the resolve they displayed afterwards was. Louis Dennis demonstrating his quality to set up our superstar DJ, and then it was Connor Wilkinson who demonstrated far more composure than the Port Vale defenders to give the O's the half-time lead they fully deserved. Wilkinson has been the victim of some nasty tackles both against Bradford City and Port Vale. Let's hope he'll recover in time for Saturday's trip to Scunthorpe. Talking of injuries, the loss of David Amu was a huge blow for John Askey's side. His replacement, Christian Montano, though, provided an exceptional strike to level the score, but the absence of any challenge on him from the Orient midfielders will be another concern for the O's coaching team. I know I got my stats wrong at the end of the match, but one that I definitely had correct was Orient's record at Vale Park was simply dreadful. Prior to last week's success, it was just two wins since the Wembley of the North opened in 1950. But the O's snatched a rare victory in the Potteries with an assist from Super Joshy Coulson and a finish from James Brophy, his first of the campaign, an important one. It was Kent Teague who said that when we became champions, we didn't have the best players in the National League, but we certainly had the best team. It was Widdowson, Happy, Coulson and Ling who were the foundation on which that oh-so-important promotion was achieved. And the past three matches, they have demonstrated a remarkable understanding and determination. Together, each appears stronger. On the road again to Scunthorpe Saturday, Neil Cox's side have had so many difficulties as a result of COVID. The Iron squad is definitely better than their lowly league place would suggest, but Ross Embleton's men go there knowing that they are capable of making it four straight wins in the league.
Well, there you have it. What a great result that was last Saturday. I thought that was more like a Justin Edinburgh side's performance, the way we hung on and got that through towards the end of that match. Billy, what do you think?
Yeah, it was great to see the grit and determination. I mean, that's the sort of game that possibly midway through the season we would have lost that game. You know. I mean, the second half, at one point in the Orient Hour WhatsApp group, I believe I used the word shambolic about the second half. So let's go through the starting lineup just in case anyone isn't aware of what it was. So we had Vigouroux in goal with Widdowson, Happy, Coulson and Ling at the back. Cisse, McEnough and Dennis in midfield with Brophy, Wilkinson and DJ up front. What did you make of the starting lineup, Jamie?
Do you know what? I thought it was quite ambitious.
Interesting to see McEnough and Dennis in the same side.
Well, yeah, and do you know what? It kind of paid off for us, didn't it? Because I thought Louis Dennis had his best 45 minutes for us in an Orient shirt on Saturday.
Yeah, had a really good game, bit of a scrappy opening. Neither side really playing particularly well. And then, obviously, Port Vale got the opening goal through Leon Legg.
Yeah, Leon Legg, please retire. Again, a set piece and Leon Legg's on the end of it. Yeah, I think he just got the jump on Dan Happy for that one. I mean, it was originally when the corner was taken, they were side by side, but you know, he got the wrong side of him and you know, it was virtually a free header at the end.
Just old manned him out of it a little bit, didn't he, really?
Yeah, he did. Yeah, no doubt about it. But and I thought we came back quite well. I mean, Port Vale, they had their chance to go two up and they never quite took it. And it took us about 15 minutes to really settle into that game. But you know, once we got back into it, you know, I thought we looked the better side for the rest of that half.
Yeah, definitely. And I thought Dennis did excellent for the assist for DJ for the equaliser.
Yeah, a lovely little chip ball in there, wasn't it?
And a great header as well. Don't realise how good Daddy Johnson is in the air, by the way, for a little bloke.
Yeah, nice leap there and a beautiful placement. No chance for the keeper.
And then Wilco puts us 2-1 up with what must be one of the most League Two goals I've ever seen. It was beautiful to watch. The ricochets, the comical defending, and a glorious end for us.
Yeah, and for a change, because it's normally us that kind of concede those kind of goals. But it was a proper old It's Knockout comedy goal. You know, where's Stuart Hall when you need him?
I was expecting Pinball Wizard to come on at one point, the way the ball was bouncing around, you know. So.
Yeah, but again, you know, fair play to Wilco for following it up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a great equaliser for Port Vale to make it 2-2. But, I mean, he had the freedom of Vale Park, the guy running through, so that's a concern.
If you're Raul Soteriō, look away now. Well, actually, look what you're doing, because, you know, he just completely lost the bloke, you know, completely misread that. And to be fair, the guy did hit a worldie.
Yeah, it was a hell of a strike. Second half, I mean, we got absolutely battered, if I'm honest with you. Absolutely battered. And it was great that Brove scored to make us 3-2 up. But I think we should have been wearing masks leaving Vale Park, because we didn't deserve anything.
Yeah, a nice big bag of swag with 3 points in it. You're right. I mean, I was looking through my notes I made during the game. All I can see in the second half is blocked by Coulson, blocked by Coulson, off the line by McEnough, blocked by Widdowson, blocked by Widdowson. But we hung on, didn't we? And like I said earlier, it's a sort of 3 points we got under Justin Edinburgh and that run in that got us promoted. The great thing about Brophy's goal is that he gambled with that.
Yeah.
And that was an absolute 100% big tick for him.
And you know what? He'd had a really quiet game as well, in my opinion. Certainly the second half, you know, he seemed really ineffective. I actually thought he was lucky to stay on the pitch and lucky not to be substituted. But there you go. So Ross Embleton making a good decision again.
Well, the thing is, it's sort of paid off for us, hasn't it? I mean, I wouldn't say we're the most like fluid football side, but we do all our best work on the break and when we're in position in the opposition half. And someone like Brophy, like I said, is always worth persevering with, because he's the only guy really who can open up the defence.
He's always a threat, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, what would you say about, so obviously Ross Embleton, I mean, the question about Ross, you know, has been ongoing and things, but we're now sixth in the league. Do you think Ross is winning over people?
Well, while he keeps on winning, of course he'll win people over. But the thing is, I'm not too excited about this run of three wins, as I wasn't too panicky about the four defeats. I still think he's finding his feet at the moment. I mean, this time last year, we was talking about him like imposing his personality on the team, you know, finding a settled side, you know, really wanting to do the job. And slowly but surely, I think, you know, I mean, 4-3-3 or 4-1-4-1, whatever you want to call it, I think it's working for him. Mm. And the one time he did change it, he got pelters because we lost at Colchester.
Yeah.
But the thing is, during this season, at some point, he's going to have to change tactics at some point. I mean, we did it when we got promoted in 2006, and we did it when we got promoted last time under Justin Edinburgh. So it's still a sort of learning curve for him. He's been in the job full time just about a year now. So I've got a funny feeling he'll come right. I mean, the great thing, squad wise for us, he's got firepower, and if you've got firepower, you've always got a chance. And look at the amount of goals we've scored this season. I mean that's got us out of jail.
I think what's interesting is that we were on a really good run before we got struck down with COVID, then we went on a terrible run, and now results have picked back up again. I mean, I wonder where we would be if we hadn't had all those COVID, all the things with COVID, with the players missing, and then obviously no game, not being able to train, going straight back into it, having people still recovering from it. I wonder where we would be if we'd have managed to just go straight through, you know?
Well, I mean, arguably we'd be, you know, top six easily. But I think you'll find other clubs now are having the problems we had 2 months ago. I mean, I think Harrogate was coming off the back of a COVID outbreak, and we steamrolled them.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when I saw the fixtures running up from Harrogate to Newport in a couple of weeks, I thought that could define our season. If we get 3 wins out of that one, we'd be right back in. Anything more than 3 wins, and then you're looking top three.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, what's coming up, we've got Newport coming up, and we've got the Boxing Day game at Cambridge. Then they turned into massive games for us.
And, you know, as Dave Victor mentioned earlier on, obviously Scunthorpe also have suffered with issues with COVID-19. So, you know, we don't know what we're going to find on Saturday when we go and play them.
Yeah, and traditionally, like Port Vale, it's a tough ground for us to go to. Don't normally got many points there. And we'll be looking to say, well, no, if we can get even a point there, that's a great result for us. That keeps us on the fringes. And then obviously we have to try and do something with the home games.
Would you keep the same side?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I would. I think the four defenders worked for us. I think they worked their socks off. I think Ling was a solid game. In fact, I think his distribution was a lot better this time around. So I think Widdowson looks much happier playing a solid left back. I'd keep that side.
Would you not bring Craig Clay back? Easy for me to say. Not bring Craig Clay back into the side.
It's tempting. It's tempting. I think that once Louis Dennis has had a decent game, I think let's keep him in, see what he does.
I think what's really good now is all of a sudden, again, you've got competition for places there. You've got Clay to come back in. You've got Hector Kyprianou. You've also got Josh Wright sitting in the wings waiting. So all of a sudden, a bit of strength in depth there. So anyway, we would like to welcome our special guest tonight. Ricky Otto, can you hear us?
Yeah, how you doing? Good to be here.
Ricky, lovely to hear from you. Thank you for joining us tonight. Really appreciate it. I'm Billy. Obviously, Jamie is my co-host tonight. And we're going to be chatting to you about your time at the Orient, your football career in general, and what you're up to now.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this.
Fantastic.
Good to have you on the
programme. Good stuff. Well, listen up. This is I'm going to try and sum up your career, shall we say, and what have you in a few lines. So, let's go for this. You served 5 jail terms. You played for 6 professional clubs. You played nearly 200 professional games. You have a degree in theology, and you appeared on Songs of Praise. Have I missed anything?
No, you've got it. I'm wondering if I'm the same person that's done all of it.
Ricky, would you mind if we talk a little bit about your life before football, before we move on?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, sure.
So before you began your football career, you were known on the streets of Hackney as Rugger Rider. Is that correct?
That was my DJ name.
Right.
We used to chat on sound system. Back in the day, there were sound systems.
Sure.
And that was my DJ name that I used to go by. At first it was Ricky Rider, and then it was Rugger Rider.
Right.
So that was just a street name that I went by.
Sure.
And what I was kind of known by people whilst I was growing up in Hackney.
And in those days, when you've... I read an article on you the other day and you described yourself as a thug, a bully and a villain. I suppose my questions to you to start off with would be, how did you survive those days, is the first one. And were you always naturally talented in football, and when did you realise that football could change your life?
Well, when I labelled myself a thief, a thug and a bully, that wasn't actually me, but that was the words of the judge that sentenced me to 4 years at the Old Bailey.
Right.
I think at that time, there was a new particular crime wave that was going throughout London, known as steaming. That's just a lot of people, going into premises, properties and stuff, and just really just ram-raiding shops and offices and stuff. And so it was a new kind of crime that was going about, and they were kind of using us as a kind of what's the word,
as an example, maybe
as an example. So ordinarily that our crime should have just gone to normal magistrates, but we ended up getting tried at the Old Bailey. And obviously, being more of a senior offender at the time than my other friends, that was what the judge labeled me. But growing up in Hackney is tough. I've always said to myself, there's only two ways that you can go. My thinking was very black and white. I didn't really have too many grey areas. And so for me, you're either doing well in school or you're not in school, which means you've probably got more time to spend on street, just getting up to mischief. And that was the path I took, albeit that I was very intelligent in school. I've done all my work, never struggled with work. I think for me, it was just about the lack of concentration. When I finished my work quick, I had time and I just got up to mischievous in school.
Yeah.
And so, by the age of 14, I was out of Main Street in school. And with that time on my hands, you tend to find yourself hanging around with like-minded people. I'm not going to sit here and say to you that I was easily led. I wasn't. I was a leader of such. So, I take full responsibility for all my actions and the things that I've done. But you're hanging around with people like-minded, you're out of mainstream school, you're not thinking career-wise.
Yeah.
But then you're left with this all-important question, where are you going to get money from? Because, at 14, 15, you want the latest trainers, you want to look nice, you want to impress the girls. And, at that age, you're too young to sign on. And so it just felt like a natural progression to get up to mischief, to trying to make money illegally. And that happened quite easily. you know, I would just take a couple of guys that we know that was older. They just asked us to stand lookout for them while they were committing a burglary. And then, you know, within about 30 minutes work, you know, we were handed like £150. And that for me was the easiest £150 I've made.
Yeah.
And that was it. I was hook, line and sinker into a life of crime. How you survive? You just do. You survive, you know. I think for every sphere of life, there is an environment. And the street is no different. The street has its own environment. It has its own language. It has its own vernacular. And you get to know who those individuals are that are on street, that are carrying the same mindset as you. And so you learn to survive. And so for me, quickly, being able to be in that environment and look after yourself, your reputation grows very quickly. And as it was for myself, you know, I was someone that was well known that could look after himself. And so, you know, mixing that with crime and then, you know, your reputation is growing, you kind of just start playing the role. And that's what I did.
Yeah. And when was it you realised that football would be a potential way to change your life?
I realised that football was going to save my life when I was serving my last prison sentence for 4 years. But I've been playing football since 7 years of age.
Right.
When I was a third year in primary school, I was already playing for the fourth year.
Right.
By the time I was playing junior football, I was already playing for Hackney. I was already playing for London. I grew up under the era of people like Paul Ince, Mickey Thomas, David Rolcastle, Merson, Adam, Vinnie Samways, because they were all the same age. And so I played against them guys regular in, you know, district football.
Yeah.
You know, I was 13. I was at West Ham United. I was playing against Paul Ince regular while he was playing for Old Ford Rovers. And I was playing for Puma in the South West Essex League. So my pedigree was always one where, had I had the right guidance, I probably would have become a professional footballer a lot earlier. But I didn't grow up with no dad. And I look back on life now, and that was pivotal in terms of maybe the direction that I took. Because I think if I had that guidance, someone that could tell me that you can make a living out of football, I probably would have, you know, continued down that road. But at 14, I didn't know how you made a living out of football.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that time, I'm staying out later, I'm hanging with my friends, interested in girls. So going to training just seemed like a long thing for me now. So I kind of left that. No one wasn't there to kind of monitor whether I'm going training or not. So I just got into a life of crime. So my pedigree for football was from school days. But I think the pivotal moment for me was when I was serving my last prison sentence, when I got 4 years for two robberies at the Old Bailey. And what happened is, normally when you go to different prisons and you go to the gym in the evening to play football, you know, and football in prison is huge. People look forward to, you know, just having those couple of hours to have a kickabout in the gym. And, you know, when you're going into a new environment and you're not known, you tend to get picked last.
Right.
And so as was per normal, normally when I'm like, when it's down to maybe three, two of us, they would say, can you play football, mate? And I would just kind of say, yeah, I'm okay.
I'm not bad.
You know. And then it's like, if you've ever watched Benny Hill, and you know the little man, when Benny Hill gets the little man out and he starts tapping them, and all of a sudden the program speeds up. And that's how it was for myself. As soon as I got the ball, you know, I just jink one or two people, bang, score a goal. And everyone now is looking and just thinking, what just happened? So my name and my reputation quickly grew in prisons because of the football. And it's funny because every institution I went to, I was playing for the prison officers team.
Right.
So every Saturday, I was coming out of the prison to play for the prison officers team.
Man, you was a ringer.
Yeah. It literally was like that, because what would happen is, you know, when I was in Dover and Rochester, Isle of Wight, I would come as a prisoner, and naturally I was the only black person because all the prison officers were white. So all the other teams will be looking at the prison officers thinking, aye, aye, who's that player over there? And they will be like, don't you worry, you just wait and see. And they will give me the ball, and then the little Benny Hill man will come out, I beat past three, four men, score a goal, and they'll be like, you know. So it was quite weird, but a lot of that happened in the young offenders institution. But what really changed it is when I went to adult prison.
Right.
Because I was doing the same thing, but this time, two men came to my cell door 2 days later after we went to the gym in Wandsworth. Now, at the time, 1988, Wandsworth was considered the worst prison in Europe. And,
right.
You know, after doing the gym, when two men come and knock on my door and said they want to talk to me. Now,
I bet that must have been terrifying.
Come to a prison, to say they want to talk to you, you start preparing for the worst. Anyway, they kind of, you know, said that I'm taking liberties with them. I won't use the word they really use, but they were saying I'm taking liberties with them. I said, what do you mean? I don't know you. They said, no, mate, you're taking liberties with us. I said, why? What have I done? They said, we was in the gym a couple of days ago watching you playing football. And they said, what are you doing in there, bro? I said, well, I'm just playing football. They said, no, no, mate, shut up for a minute. What are you doing in there? Because if I had what you had, I'd never be sitting in this place, mate. Do you know what I mean? And so they gave me a real good kick up the backside. And if you can imagine, this was the first time any real adult, male adult, had spoken any real affirmation into my life. I knew I could play football well. I knew my pedigree was well. But sometimes you still need to be told. And because I never had a father, I didn't have my uncles around, my granddad, they weren't interested in that. Because I wasn't told, when that was told to me that, listen, bruv, you can play football. And if I was you, I would never be sitting in prison. And they left me with a term that I use now today when I work in the prison. They say, bruv, if I was you, don't serve the time, let the time serve you.
Yeah.
And what they were really saying is don't just sit down in prison and just do nothing and then when you get released, then start thinking about what you want to do. If I was you, mate, use the gym to your advantage. Start getting yourself physically fit so that when you come out, you can hit the floor running if you get a try. And that was the only word of encouragement I needed. And that took for me to go to an adult prison because in young offenders, everyone's the same age, young. Everyone wants to give it Larry Large and play the bad man.
Yeah.
No one's really looking to encourage you and inspire you to do better or to come out of the environment. But in adult prison, that was the catalyst moment for me. And that was the word I needed. And so, you know, I became a gym orderly. I was playing with the prison officers. So I was playing football every day. Just waiting for that one opportunity that when I come out, I will grab it with both hands. Because for me, all I needed to do is stay on the street long enough to wait for the opportunity to come. Because I know football-wise, I'm good enough. My pedigree is good. But I needed to come away from certain people, certain places, and stay on the street long enough. So for me, I think, you know, my catalyst moment was definitely when I was serving my 4 years in prison and those two guys spoke into my life.
That's incredible. That's amazing. And when you came out of prison, then you got your first sort of break with Haringey Borough and you played for them for just under a year, wasn't it, before Orient came knocking. So how did that come about, the move to the O's then?
Well, what happened is, on the 30th of April, 1987, I had to answer bail for the crime that I eventually got 4 years.
Sure.
But that evening, I just got promoted from Newmont Travel to play for the A team.
Right.
But I had to answer bail. And so when I went to answer bail and I knew I wasn't going to get bail, I was, you know, stuck in the police station until the next day to go to court. Now, if you saw my face, you would know I'm annoyed. I'm upset, obviously, because I'm in custody.
Yeah.
But you would be mistaken if you thought that I was upset because I was in custody. I was upset because I couldn't get to play in the A team for the first time, you know. And obviously what happened while I was incarcerated, Newmont Travel then amalgamated with Haringey Borough.
Right,
so
right.
At least half of the players that I was playing with, once I got remanded in custody, when I came out, they were looking for me. Because, again, remember, 1990, there weren't no mobile phones.
Sure.
So someone just heard that I'd been released, and so they was coming to my house. And so one of the players come to my house to see if it was true that I come out. When he saw me open the door, he said, listen, this is what's happened. This is where we're training now. We're not training where we was before, 3 years ago. We're training at Haringey Borough. So they just told me to come training. So I went training. I went training on Thursday. I was playing in the A team on Saturday.
And, that's amazing, isn't it?
I played about 8 games for Haringey Borough, but I got injured. I think I just done a little bit of my ligament in my knee. But again, you know, the Haringey Borough, they didn't even have the facilities to treat me.
Sure.
So they sent me to go down to Dartford because the manager, Neville Watson, was good friends with another guy, the coach of Dartford at the time, his name was Mickey Springer.
Right.
So I had to go with Mickey Springer, who lived in Hackney but drove to Dartford every Tuesday and Thursday, just so I can get treatment. And so while I was getting treatment at Dartford for a couple of weeks, I played about 2-3 games. But by that stage, there was a lot of interest, and Orient was the first one to make their move.
Right.
And gave me a call to say I should come for a try, a week's try. And that was it. I went for a week's try. If I go on history, I've never been refused by any team. So I kind of was very excited, you know, because I'm a local boy, I'm Hackney. you know, I played on the marshes. We used to try to bunk into Orient when we were younger.
Must have tried to bunk out.
Yeah. You know, so to actually kind of, you know, being asked to come for a trial, you know, I was majorly happy. And between me and you, without being cocky or anything, because sometimes, you know, you have a good feeling when, you're somewhere and you do something well.
It just feels
right. I probably knew after about 3 days, I'm in.
Yeah.
I knew, the training went well. You know, I think you could see, even though John Gorman at the time, he was the youth team coach, and he was coaching on that day. Even though he was trying to keep a straight face about it, I knew that one or two things that I'd done, I could see the excitement on his face. And then the next day, you know, Peter Eustace came out. And then the next day, Frank Clark came out. So, you're doing something good. So I kind of knew by about the third day, I've got a very good chance of getting a contract here. And then we had a behind closed doors game against Gillingham. And I think they wanted to kind of see how I would do. At that time, I think Gillingham had just got relegated to the third division.
Right.
They spent a lot of years in the second division. So I think I was playing against a guy, I can't remember his name, but he was a well-established right back in the Football League. And I'd done very well against him. I think we won the game and I set up a couple of goals.
Sure.
And it was on that Friday that they offered me a contract.
That's fantastic. And is it true that your mum didn't believe you were going to get a contract? Is that right?
Yeah, because I think, as any parent would think, when I came out in January 1990. And, you know, I'm promising my mum that, yeah, I'm going to, you know, get my life straight. I'm not going to commit any more crime and everything. Mm. But I was saying that same story up until July.
Right, right.
Now, my mum gave me some money because, obviously, when I came out July, I didn't start playing football until pre-season. So it wasn't until pre-season July that I went over to Haringey Borough. And even then, by that stage, I had no football boots, I had no shorts, I had no kit. So, you know, I had to borrow some money off my mum. So it was an investment that I was really assuring her that something's going to come out of it. But she wasn't that confident because from January to July, you know, I think she was maybe thinking that I'm still getting up to no good because there's no job, I'm not working. And, you know, like most offenders face, when you come out and you ain't got no job and you ain't got no money, you go back to what you know.
Sure.
It seemed to be the easiest thing. And so I think for a long while, my mum kind of thought I'm going to go down that road. And so it was hilarious when you think, when I came on one day and, you know, my mum comes and says, Ricky, someone from Leighton, Frank Clark, Leighton Orient. Yes, in front. You must go there on Monday for some trial. I said, yes, I'm in. Just like that. And she's like, shut up. What are you? You never got it. I said, listen, mum, when have I ever gone for a trial and not got in? You know, and so that was it. And so when I actually got the contract and I signed the contract, for me, the most brisk walk I've ever completed was the walk when I walked out of the stadium at Brisbane Road and I walked across the marshes back to my house just to show my mum the contract. And it was a great moment.
That's such a fantastic story. I love that. I think Jamie's got a couple of questions for you.
Yeah, I'm just saying, we had a sneaky peek of your skill in the pre-season match versus Real Valladolid when you first kind of got into the frame of getting the first team start. Can you remember playing against Colombia's Valderrama?
That's right, I remember. Yeah, he was a big player at the time as well, isn't it?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, huge.
Yeah.
Big hair as well.
Yeah, massive.
Yeah, I think they were just associating, you know, it was a game of the dreadlocks. His dreadlocks was blonde and mine was black at the time. So, didn't we win the game?
You won, and I think you had a shot which was palmed out and Kevin Nugent headed in from close. Yeah. But you set it up, basically. And then I think the week after was your full league debut at Brentford, which I can honestly say is one of the best debuts that I ever saw in the 4-3.
Gosh, man, honestly, I mean, I was nervous, excited, all at the same time. But if there was ever a perfect debut, now when I look back at it couldn't have gone any better for me. The only glitch was that I should have put that last chance that I had away. And I chose to kind of place it around the keeper, but it just went slightly wide of the post. But other than that, I think, you know, I couldn't have asked for more. You know, it was lovely, it was hot, perfect day. And really just a great way for me to just introduce myself to professional football. The crowd was amazing. Honestly, I think that game, it cemented the relationship I had with Orient from the get-go.
Yeah.
Because I think I was still an unknown entity. I didn't come through no youth rank, so there was no intel on me.
Yeah.
You know, I was just someone that, you know, people were just hearing about in pre-season.
Yeah.
And so that game really catapulted me into, I think, the hearts of Orient fans.
And what did Frank Clark say to you that day on your debut? Did he sort of say, just go and be free, just go and have fun? Or did he say, you know, like, you know, you've got a specific role, I need you to do this?
No, well, to be fair, it was Peter Eustace, really, that was taking everything. Frank Clark didn't come into the change rooms until after the game.
Right, okay.
But it was Peter Eustace, and it wasn't so much, you know, to go and be free, because I think we was well drilled, you know, in terms of our defensive duties and being tight and compact. And so, you know, I think, you know, the word from the gaffer at the time was, listen, you know, keep things tight, you know, remember your positions when we ain't got the ball. But obviously, yeah, when you've got the ball in the last third, express yourself.
Yeah.
And I think, again, being an unknown entity, they didn't know how I was going to maybe function. You know, maybe would the occasion get the better of me? And so it was that kind of instruction. But as the game unfolded, even though we lost, I think after the game, Peter Eustace know that I was probably going to get the headline. Because
sure.
Obviously I set up all the goals. And so when I got into the change room, I'm expecting him to say, Rick, well done, man. Great debut. He just came over to me and he was all angry. He's just like, and you, don't you dare talk to the press when you leave this changing room. I was like, I had a good game, but I didn't understand it at the time. But now when I look back at it, I knew that he was preparing me for the press, because six games later, when my performance was still good, it was still high intensity, the problem that we had now is that the press wanted to know, who is this dreadlocks guy playing on the wing of Leighton Orient that's reminding us of John Chidozie and Laurie Cunningham? That was the talk that was coming out. And,
right, wow.
And so I had to have a conversation with Frank Clark and Peter Eustace, because they were like saying, look, you know, we've got 4, 5, 6 different press. They want to know who you are. And we don't really know how to say this because, you know, you're coming straight from prison. So how do you feel about how much intel of your life you want to tell them? And I said, well, look, I think the best way to just deal with it is just to be transparent and be open. There's no point in maintaining the mystery, because obviously people are wanting to know more. And if you don't give them something, it just makes the circus continue. So what they've done is that they got one of the reporters from the People, Sunday People.
Right.
And we came and done a spread. And funny enough, the week it came out was the week when Terry Fenwick got imprisoned. I think it was for drink driving. So there he is going in prison, and there's me saying, I'm coming from prison.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was quite weird, but yeah, that's what happened. And I think after the Brentford game, it made sense to me now why Peter Eustace didn't want me to talk to the press on my own. Because maybe in the excitement, I may have said things that, you know, might not have come out right without speaking to them first. So, yeah, so that was it. That's how we kind of broke the news to the world that, listen, hey, this is who I am. This is where I'm coming from. And I'm just really just trying to come away from that life and make a living for myself.
And it's amazing how, obviously, nowadays everyone's media trained and stuff like that. And I suppose, you know, Peter Eustace and Frank Clark kind of did that for you all the way back then, back in 1990.
Yeah, they did. And I suppose, again, back then, again, remember, there weren't social media.
Yeah.
So I don't think it was so much that you had to watch your P's and Q's. I think it was just a case of them making sure I understood the glare that's going to come onto me.
Yeah.
So, you know what you're walking into, and know that when you give them information, you know, you've got to be comfortable with that information. You've got to be comfortable with the reality that you may go to other away grounds and they may start to say things against where you're coming from that can affect your game.
You know,
because once you let the cat out of the bag, you know, not everyone's going to be happy with the fact that, you know, I used to commit crime.
Mm-hmm.
And now, although I'm coming out and I've got a second chance, some people are going to use that to try and distract you from the game if you continue to do well. So I think it was more, they knew I could talk well. They knew I was okay in that respect. They knew I understood what it meant to wear the badge of Orient and what it means, and that everything I say has a reflection on the club. I think they just wanted to prepare me for what happens now when you've got the press prying into your life. And I think they were magnificent in just grooming me in that respect.
Yeah. Jamie?
Yeah, I'm going back to when you first broke into the team. Now, we had some pretty exciting players at the club at the time. We had people like Chris Bart Williams, Kenny Achimpong, Danny Carter, Lee Harvey. What was it like playing with them?
Absolutely amazing. I think I was texting, just talking quickly to Terry Howard, literally about a week ago.
Right.
And
friend of the show, Terry Howard. He comes in here and he's off and on with us.
Really?
Yeah, listen, yeah, yeah. That's great.
I've got to take my hat off to all of them guys, because honestly, I think what helped is Danny Carter comes from Hackney.
Yeah.
And I remember playing for Albion on Saturday, and Danny, there was a young Danny Carter probably playing for the team younger than me. Right. But he went to Hackney Free, and a lot of my cousins went to Hackney Free. So Danny Carter knew of me. He knew of the reputation I had, but he also knew that reputation didn't always precede me. I was still an approachable guy. You know what I mean? I could still get on with people. And so I think when I came into the club, Danny was the first person that came to me and just introduced me to the rest of the guys. And honestly, it was like I was family. It felt like home from day one, you know. Like I said, within a week, you know, the banter between myself, Warren Hackett, Wayne Bennett, you know, Achimpong, Steve Castle, Adrian, it was hilarious. I mean, I felt at home because my pedigree was always football.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I didn't feel like I was walking into an environment that was completely oblivious to me. Football was my pedigree. So when I walked into this group, you know, they were young, we were all around the same age. We all, you know, really just wanted to make a living out of football, and we was prepared to do whatever we could do to be the best player that we can be. But the camaraderie was absolutely ridiculous, and that made it all the better. You know, coming into training, you couldn't wait to get into the training, because the more I get to know those guys, it was a pleasure to play with them. And, you know, even when harsh things needed to be said, it was said in the right way, because, you're working with people that want to win. But as soon as the game finished, it was forgotten. It wasn't, you know, there was no animosity. And for me, I couldn't have chose a perfect introduction into professional football, considering the background that I'm coming in with, coming from prison, where most of those guys have done apprenticeships with clubs. I couldn't have come into a greater bunch of guys, because at no time at all did they make me feel like an outsider.
What would you say your favourite Orient memory is?
My favourite Orient memory?
I know, it's a big question, isn't it?
Gosh.
The hat-trick at Brighton must be up there.
It is. But if I'm honest, it's signing that first professional contract.
Right, yeah.
Because you've got to understand, man, that you know, I've been in and out of prison from 17 years of age. My last sentence, 4 years. I went in at 19, came out at 22. The chances of me going back to prison was a lot more higher than me becoming a professional footballer.
Yeah.
So the odds were stacked against me, man. And, you know, let's be honest, right? Black players back then were still struggling to get into the game. They weren't coming into the game in their droves like now.
Yeah.
And especially with a criminal past. I really needed someone, a manager, a coach, to look past that just for a minute, and just to look at the football in me.
Yeah.
And if they can see the football in me and forget the past and say, you know what, we're going to give you the opportunity to prove yourself, it doesn't get any bigger than that for me. Because let me tell you something, that first contract, and I'll be honest with you, I signed for £100 a week.
Yeah.
I know all the other players, they were on bigger money. I knew that. But on that moment when I signed that contract, I was earning more than all of them, because that contract saved my life. And for me, it doesn't get bigger, because for me, the most important thing at that time was, Rick, I'm not going back to prison. And I've got one opportunity, one chance to make it as a footballer. So, you know, scoring a hat-trick at Brighton was great. You know, scoring my first goal for Orient was brilliant. The debut was absolutely ridiculous. But all of that wouldn't have happened if Frank Clark and Peter Eustace didn't look past the crime and just saw me as a player.
That's a brilliant story. I love it. That's fantastic. And you did. You grabbed your opportunity with both hands. And obviously, after three great seasons at the O's, you then moved to Southend for £100,000 and to play for Barry Fry. And he then took you on to Birmingham for at the time a club record signing fee of £800,000. How was it playing for Barry Fry?
It was a lot different than what I was used to, because at Orient, training was very structured. Mm. You know, Peter Eustace, he was a stickler for shape, position, moving as a unit. And so a lot of the training sometimes could be monotonous because you're going over things and, yeah. You know, you're, sometimes you just want to just have a good kick around, good five and five. But, you know, that helped my game in terms of positional awareness and stuff like that. But with Barry Fry, it was different in the sense that it seemed like there was a lot more freedom.
Sure.
You know, we're coming to training. We wouldn't be so much stuck on all the fine details. Barry Fry's philosophy was, I brought you here because I believe you're a good player, so go out and express yourself.
Right.
Now, in the beginning, that worked well. That was great because you come into training, you do 20 minutes of detailed work, what the opposition, what they work, so let's just do something on them. And that, before you know it, you're back playing five-a-side, doing all the ollies and everything like that. And, you know, training just seemed great. But I realised, as I started to mature more into football, that, you know, if you want to do better, you need to do the boring stuff more.
Yeah, you need to be disciplined.
You know, because you've got to be able to have that discipline. But in saying that, I take nothing away. You know, Barry Fry was a player's manager. I think his time in non-league football helped to really cultivate players from the lower league that really felt like they had something to prove, or I think he knew if he gave certain players like myself the opportunity to play on a higher platform, we would grab it with both hands. And so signing for Southend, for me, it was a good progression move because at the time it meant I can play in the Championship today, which was the old First Division. And so for myself, I felt like, well, I felt confident enough that I can play at that level. And so I took the opportunity. I think everything that I'd done at Orient, it took me to that next level. I don't think I left Orient prematurely. I think I spent 2.5 years at Orient, and I think it was very clear that it was only a matter of time that I may move on to a higher platform. And so when that opportunity came, and it was Southend, I took it. And playing for Southend, another great club, although maybe small in stature, but huge in character. The fans, you know, the staff. Very much like Orient, you know, and sometimes playing for big clubs, as much as you want to play for big clubs, but I noticed when I played for Birmingham, something I didn't feel at Birmingham is what I felt at Orient and what I felt at Southend.
Yeah.
And that is your connection with the crowd, the staff,
yeah,
and everybody down to the kit man, the lady that will be cooking your meals after training. You know, something closer and intimate happens when you're at the smaller club. So I was able to kind of develop that same relationship with Southend very quickly and hit the floor running. And, you know, for the year and a half that I was at Southend, you know, I think that just made me a better player. I was able to showcase my skills on a higher platform. And it was no surprise to most that when Barry Fry became manager of Birmingham, that it was only a matter of time that he was going to come in for myself, as does what managers do. You know, when they've worked with players before, you know, managers want to kind of rubber stamp their style of play very quickly. And so when Barry Fry called me to come to play for Birmingham, it just seemed like a natural progression for me.
Talking about a higher plane, as you just mentioned just now, we've only got about 2 or 3 minutes left, Ricky, but I'd really like to talk to you about the work you're doing now as a pastor and your degree in theology. Have you always been a spiritual man, or did that happen after your football days? Or
no, I mean, I really noticed something spiritual about myself more while I was incarcerated in 1988, but I kept a lot of those feelings to myself because I really didn't know how to articulate what I was feeling. I always believed in God, you know.
Yeah.
So that was no problem to me. And so when I really started to feel that spiritual pull to explore, I didn't explore it until 2004. But once I explored it and became a born again Christian, that's when I went to uni to study theology.
Sure.
Because it was very clear by then that I believe God was leading me towards the pastorate, the pastoral ministry. And so I just feel like I'm just following in my calling again, in doing pastoral ministry, and at the moment still trying to complete my book, which is called From Prison Pitch to the Pulpit, which I think it just explains three major areas of my life: the prison, the pitch, and now the pulpit.
Well, if there's anything we can do to help promote that when it's ready, you just let us know, and we'll definitely mention that on air.
So, I really appreciate that, and I wish we had more time. It's good to be able to speak to you, because I'll be honest with you, it's only over the last year I've really kind of put myself out there to kind of connect with some of the fans, because looking back, I've never really said goodbye to the club that I've been at, and now living in Birmingham, I felt like, you know what, Rick, I kind of want to connect with some people, because I've got some great memories, and I believe that I've left people with some great memories. And this is why, for me, talking with you guys today is pivotal for my kind of rehab, because for a lot of years, I've kind of just kept myself to myself. But talking with you guys and just sharing these memories is it's doing wonders for my self-esteem, I can tell you.
I mean, I'm hooked already. I'm not a big autobiography reader, if I'm honest with you, you know. But as soon as that's out, I'm getting it, because, you know, the story you've told us today is just incredible, you know. So that's tremendous, you know. Ricky, if you'd like, we'd love to have you back on the show at a later date to, you know, just to talk more in depth about your career. Obviously, we've not really touched on Birmingham that much. We've not really touched on too much Southend and what have you, and stuff like that. So we'd love to have you back on.
Whenever you're ready, man, it will be a pleasure. It will be an absolute pleasure. You just give me the call. To be fair, I'm quite flexible time, because obviously I work full time in ministry, so sure. Evening times I'm free. Just let me know when, and it'd be a pleasure to speak with you guys.
Well, thank you for coming on tonight, Ricky. We really, really appreciate it. You take care of yourself and have a lovely Christmas.
And you too, guys. Take care, man.
All the best.
Thanks, Ricky. All the best.
Bye-bye. Now.
That was Ricky Otto, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, what a fantastic interview.
Wow. We could have gone the Orient 2 hours, couldn't we?
Oh, and more than that, possibly, yeah. So we've got a quick message from Steve Jenkins now about the Somme. So Andy's just queuing that up right now, and we're just going to give you a little bit more information. That's obviously, this year's trip didn't necessarily go ahead, but we're hoping to get that sorted.
Steve, and just an apology first of all from everybody here that we ran out of time with you 2 weeks ago when you were on the show, and you were about to make an announcement. So fire away, my friend, and let everybody know what you wish to let them know.
Okay, well, this is all a bit cryptic, but this goes back to the recent stakeholders meeting when I was there representing the Overstar Memorial Fund and the Supporters Club. The discussions about building closer ties with Park Midlothian in Scotland due to both clubs' history in the Great War. And it really is great to see the Orient looking to build closer ties with Hearts. And at the same time, I mentioned that the Somme Fund's been working on a project which has been for about 8 years now. This is how long it's taken. And I can't actually tell you what it is at the moment, but it's that important, it's taken that long, that we're hoping to get this out in the new year. It should have happened this year because of the coronavirus. It's been put on hold, but it is something that we've been working on that's going to enable all those fans to get involved and to embrace what we've got coming up. It really is a big event, and we're really excited about it.
So it's a bit cryptic, to say the least, but
it makes up for the fact that there's no Somme trip next year, and due again to the way the virus has really hit everybody and all the practicalities of arranging a trip of that magnitude, but we are confident that what's going to be happening is going to really be really an exciting time for those fans. Obviously, not everyone's got an interest in the Great War, but what it will do, it'll give a added pride to being an Orient supporter. And that's all I can say. Obviously, the committee of the Somme Fund is myself, Peter Kitchen, Alex Hartford, and Malcolm McCarthy. And I can assure you, this has taken a lot of hard work and dedication to get where we are at the moment. So it is a snippet, and hopefully we'll be in a position to make an official announcement in the new year. And as I said at the stakeholders meeting, the football club will be the first people to know out of courtesy. And once they've got the official go-ahead, or the nod, as it were, then obviously we'll be letting the various agencies know of what's happening. But it's going to be good, and it'll be a great opportunity to really further the name of Leighton Orient throughout the land.
Thanks very much, Steve. Take care.
There you go. So a cryptic event there potentially happening in the near future. So something to look forward to. Are we running a book on what it's going to be? Or
It could be anything, couldn't it?
Okay, so just to finish us off tonight, we were saddened at the Orient Hour to hear of the passing of Sandy Risley. Sandy was a member of the Orient backroom staff and was well loved by everyone at the club. We'd like to send our condolences to Sandy's family and to everyone at the club who was connected with Sandy. Jamie?
Yeah, I didn't really know much about him, but obviously he's a well-respected member of the Orient community, and I should only hope that we give him the send-off he deserves tonight.
Yeah, so we're going to play out the show tonight with a little song that Sandy made famous. It's Ebb Tide by the Righteous Brothers, which we'll put on in a couple of minutes' time. And there's a wonderful story about how Paul Hyde's testimonial gig was going ahead, and there was a band playing and everything, and it got to the end of the night, and the band had just packed away, but they'd left the mics on. So Sandy, after a few beers, tottered up to the microphone, grabbed hold of it, and he proceeded to belt out the Righteous Brothers' Ebb Tide, absolutely pitch perfect, and everyone in the whole room was just mesmerised by it. And as he finished, he was given a huge round of applause by everyone that was in the room. So, Sandy, if you're listening up there, hopefully you'll enjoy this, and this is the way we play the show out tonight. So, rest in peace, Sandy, and we'll leave you with the Righteous Brothers and Ebb Tide. Thank you very much, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you, Billy.
And we'll see you all next week on the Orient Hour.
First the tide rushes in, plants a kiss on the shore, then rolls out to sea, and the sea is very still once more. So I'll rush to your side like the oncoming tide with one end, I'm at peace.